This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. You've heard there's a big Los Angeles mayoral election, right? And maybe you've already received your mail-in ballot. But you may have heard a lot less about another election with an impact on a lot of people. That is the race for county supervisor in a chunk of LA County that includes almost all of the Valley, plus Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, and West Hollywood. For the first time, most of the San Fernando Valley will be represented by a single board member. And the winner of that seat will go on to represent 2 million people in LA County. That's more people than the entire population of more than a dozen states. Well, the new supervisor will join a small body of elected officials that you can literally count on one hand, who wield enormous powers. But so far, the candidates have done few things you associate with campaigns. No TV and radio advertising blitzes. No election rallies. No get-out-the-vote campaigns. But that dearth of active campaigning hasn't stopped Saul Gonzalez, host of KQED's The California Report, from going out and reporting on this race and telling you why this election for supervisor is so important.
On a recent Sunday morning at Santa Monica's Clover Park, something pretty unusual happened in this year's nearly invisible race for a seat on the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. An actual face-to-face event was held between a candidate and supporters.
Well, thanks for coming. I'm Henry Stern. I'm running for county supervisor.
Stern, a Democratic state senator, is considered one of the top three candidates running for LA County's 3rd Supervisorial District. The others are Stern's fellow state senator Robert Hertzberg and Lindsay Horvath, a West Hollywood City Council member. All are registered Democrats. Whoever wins the seat, now held by departing incumbent Sheila Kuehl, will become one of the most powerful elected officials in California, one of 5 supervisors governing a county of 10 million residents, the most populous in the country, and administering a nearly $40 billion budget. Stern says his current job as a state senator might seem high profile, but being in Sacramento, he says, can't compare to the clout of LA County supervisors and their ability to affect people's lives.
They wear a fancy pin up there, and there's red carpet and a fancy building, and all the lobbyists make you feel like you're a big deal and you feel famous. Turns out no one's really that famous in the state Senate. But when you look at homelessness or you look at the care crisis going on, it's all county. And so I want to do the job with the most amount of power to help people with the least amount of kind of fluff.
So when it comes to pure substance, you think, oh, county, that is being a county supervisor, that is the place to be.
Absolutely. That's the secretly the most powerful job in all of L.A.
And Stern's views are echoed by someone who used to have the job.
The county of Los Angeles and the County Board of Supervisors is a place where virtually every issue that matters to the general public crosses your desk every day. It's a very powerful job. 3 votes on any given Tuesday can move mountains.
That's Zev Yaroslavsky, who is an LA County supervisor from 1994 to 2014, representing the same district that Stern, Hertzberg, and Horvath are running to represent now. Yaroslavsky says that historically, a lot of people, especially middle-class voters, haven't grasped the importance of county government and its services to millions of people, services that can literally mean the difference between life and death.
The county is the human service arm of our society. They deal with the people who are economically marginalized, who are the poor, people who are coping with mental illness, children who have been abandoned by their parents. So the foster care program, adoptions, mental health, public health, criminal justice, the jails. The overwhelming majority of the budget of the county is in service of people who are on the low end of the economic income spectrum.
These sweeping powers have also placed LA County government and the supervisors squarely in the middle of some of the biggest and most controversial local issues of our time, like the public health response to the COVID pandemic and how best to help tens of thousands of homeless and mentally ill on the streets. But the county's exact powers compared to the state and the city of Los Angeles can often be confusing to the public.
If I could get you over here at the picnic table, we're going to go ahead and get started with our training so we can get you out knocking doors and talking to voters to get Henry elected.
Yes.
Back at the Henry Stern campaign event, voter Steve Thornton acknowledged that despite his support for the candidate, he didn't know much about the scope of county government or the authority of its supervisors. He said he was here because his labor union local was backing Stern.
You know, as far as his hierarchy and what everybody does, I really don't. I'm clueless, man. I don't know.
But including the supervisors.
Absolutely right. I'm just a simple guy, man. I do my job, I do my part, and hopefully they do their part, man. That's it.
And even less well-known to a lot of voters than the powers of L.A. County supervisors is that the borders of county supervisorial districts were redrawn last year by an independent citizens redistricting commission. That means the third supervisorial district that Stern and his opponents, Robert Hertzberg and Lindsay Horvath, are vying to lead, now includes more of the San Fernando Valley and less territory south of the Hollywood Hills.
It is a district that's more valley, more moderate, less west side, and less liberal.
That's Rafael Sonenshine, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA and an expert on county government. He says to win, the supervisorial candidates running must do well among Valley voters who have historically felt marginalized by LA leaders. In 1977 and again in 2002, Valley residents even tried to secede from the city of Los Angeles. But Sonenshine says the San Fernando Valley of today isn't the valley of a generation ago.
So for a long time, it appeared to be kind of white middle-class community at odds with the growing metropolis of all of Los Angeles. But that narrative doesn't hold quite as much anymore. For one thing, a majority of the population is non-white in the valley. The Northeast San Fernando Valley is overwhelmingly Latino. So I think when we only think of the valley's complaints as being about white suburbanites alienated from urban Los Angeles, that's a fairly old story. I think that's part of the story, but it is not the whole story.
That's why Sonenshine says the top candidates for the third supervisorial district all have similar progressive agendas, like fighting climate change, creating supportive housing for the homeless, and supporting strong pro-union policies. Election day is June 7th. If a supervisorial candidate doesn't get more than 50% of the vote, the top two candidates will square off against one another in a runoff election in November. For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, speaking of elections, a race we haven't been hearing so much about is the one to replace city attorney Mike Feuer, who's running for mayor. There are seven candidates in the city attorney's race. Unusual for L.A., two of the frontrunners have run for office before as Republicans. Marisa Gerber is reporting on the race for the L.A. Times, and she's with us right now. Marisa, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So tell us about the importance of the office of city attorney. I mean, what does the city attorney do?
Yeah, so city attorney is a race we don't hear about as often as, you know, mayor or something like that, but it's a really important role. I mean, they handle misdemeanor prosecutions for the city. They do a bunch of other things. And in recent history, at least, it's often been a stepping stone politically to other races, you know, like Mike Feuer now running for mayor. So yeah, a very important office.
So seven people in the race, Marisa, who are the top contenders at this point?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways to look at it. When you look at overall money raised, by far the most has come to Fossil Gill. He has loaned most, a majority of the money to himself, but him, and then behind him is Teddy Kapoor, and then third is Kevin James.
Two of the top candidates, as I mentioned at the outset, Marisa, are former Republicans. This is Gill and James, right? They say they've changed political identification. How have they addressed their former allegiance to the GOP? Because obviously it's kind of difficult to get elected in the city of L.A. as a Republican, right?
Sure. Yeah. It certainly isn't impossible, but it is, you know, like one expert I talked to said, not a plus. They've both addressed, you know, past comments they've made and said that they have, you know, been Democrats for many years now and have apologized for some of their comments they've made in the past and said that they've worked in recent years to prove their allegiance to the Democratic Party.
What kind of comments did they make? Do we have anything on the record that was controversial?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Fossil Gill, who the candidate I mentioned who'd raised the most money, ran for the Virginia House of Delegates in 2007 as a Republican. The year, I believe before that, there was a marriage amendment in Virginia where he was living at the time, and he made some public comments saying that he believed that marriage was between a man and a woman. He said since then he's done a, you know, had a lot of self-reflection and, you know, says he was flatly said, I was wrong for that. The other candidate who ran as a Republican, Kevin James, you know, started out as a lawyer, then did a stint as a talk radio host. And during that era, he wrote some columns on townhall.com, you know, said things like call Democrats global warming wimps, used phrase like illegal alien invasion, predicted Obama would pick, he said, Daffy Duck for Supreme Court. So he's gotten some flack for those comments. And he, too, apologized. He said he's apologized many times for those comments. And he pointed out that, you know, he has backing from Mayor Eric Garcetti and many others. And he said that he believes that shows that he is not like he was back then.
Let's talk about the other candidates in the race, the other names that are not so well known either.
Sure. Yeah. So Teddy Kapoor is an attorney. He does restructuring cases. And in my conversation with him, he mentioned that, you know, he's been a volunteer with an organization that works with families who've experienced homelessness for several years. He said he felt that that experience would help him lead with urgency and compassion on that issue. Marina Torres, who has some experience on the civil side, was a federal prosecutor for years, and was also a political appointee in the Obama administration working on DACA cases. Heidi Feldstein Soto, who's a finance law attorney, and she said in my conversation with her, she pointed out that she has extensive managerial experience, which she pointed out was an important experience to have going into the city attorney's office. Richard Kim, who is a deputy city attorney, and he told me that he decided to run for office only when he saw that no one else in his office was running. And then Sherio Nicavaya Cole, who also worked in the city attorney's office for about 15 years. She got fired a few years ago, she says, she says it was retaliation for speaking up against management. She talked a lot about her experience as an Afro-Latina growing up in Tijuana. So those are the seven.
Seven people in the race. Of course, the primary election coming up on June 7th. Marisa Gerber, reporter for the LA Times. Marisa, thanks.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Again, you may have already received your ballot in the mail. You can mail those back in, or you can drop them off at ballot drop-off boxes. You'll also be able to vote early if you choose at voting locations across the county, along with those that are open on Election Day, June 7th. Here to tell us a little bit more about how all of that is going to work is the guy in charge, LA County Registrar Recorder, County Clerk Dean Logan. Dean, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Steve.
Mail-in ballots have been going out. I've received mine. When should folks expect theirs to arrive if say you haven't gotten it yet?
If voters haven't received a ballot by the end of this week, so around the 14th or 15th, that would be sort of the trigger point to reach out to us so we can check that, see if we need to put a replacement ballot in the mail to you. There's also a ballot tracking system that voters can sign up for on our website or on the Secretary of State's website that will actually send you text messages or emails letting you know that the ballot has been sent out by the post office. And likewise, once you vote that ballot and return it, you can track to make sure that we receive that back and that it has been counted.
Those have to be mailed in by June 7th, right? Like it has to be postmarked by the 7th, right?
That's correct. So think of June 7th as the final day of the election, and that's the day that you need to be sure you have cast your ballot. So either voting in person or marking that mail ballot and getting it back to us. And if you are returning it through the mail, then you're exactly right. That has to be postmarked by Election Day, June 7th, in order to be valid.
Tell us more about these voting centers, Dean. They've been around now for a couple of years, but they also sort of got mixed in with COVID, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Really, our initial rollout was in that March 2020 primary. But that model is continuing. That is that every voter is mailed a vote by mail ballot to ensure they have the opportunity to cast a ballot. But then 10 days before the election, we begin opening these vote centers. And a vote center is an in-person voting opportunity. Voters in the county can go to any of the vote centers that are open in the county, so they are not limited to a specific location. And that extends up to election day. Now, some of the services of the vote center and why they're so important is that those devices have the accessibility features that allow a voter to vote independently and privately. They also offer the ballot in 18 languages in addition to English, which is a requirement under the Federal and State Voting Rights Act. And then finally, the vote centers also serve as a location for voters or eligible citizens who have not yet registered to vote but decide in those final 10 days that they want to register and participate in the election. You can actually register to vote and cast a ballot at any of those vote centers.
So you have until what date to register to vote for the June 7th primary?
Yeah, so you have until May 23rd to register and for us to mail you a ballot. But registration remains open continuously, including on election day itself. So you can go to a vote center, register to vote. What would happen in that case is you would be issued what's called a conditional registration ballot. It is a valid ballot, but it is put into a separate envelope and held out until your voter registration is processed and validated through the state data system.
How do you find out, Dean, where you go to vote if you're wanting to go to that vote center?
Sure. A couple different ways to do that. There is a vote center lookup feature on our website at lavote.gov. You can put in your address or on your personal device. It actually will track your GPS and let you know the location closest to you, but also lists all of the locations. So again, you can choose whatever location you want to go to. Additionally, next week, we will be mailing a postcard to every registered voter that will identify the locations that are closest to their residence and then provide them with the dates and hours that are available at those vote centers.
What do you say, Dean, to people who tell you, you know, you send out a ballot to every registered voter in California and there is opportunity for chicanery there?
The system has been subject to post-election audits. It's been subject to litigation and to the observation of political party representatives or the general public. And again, it has been demonstrated to have the security and integrity that voters should expect in an election system.
Dean Logan, L.A. County Registrar, Recorder, County Clerk. Dean, as always, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
More on the upcoming primary election, by the way, and any story you want to see and hear at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. And while you're there, how about a contribution to KCRW during our spring fundraiser? We know it's a tough time, yeah, and things are more expensive for you. We get it. They are for us, too. But if you have the means and you can throw in some money to help us keep doing what we do, that would very much be appreciated. Got to admit, we're a little behind where we need to be at this point in the drive, so if you can dig deep, give by tomorrow night, say, you'll also be entered to win a brand new iPhone. Go to kcrw.com/give during our spring fundraiser. Thank you so much for your support of KCRW. Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the month of April, which was National Poetry Month, KCRW's Young Creators Project set to find 5 talented young poets and storytellers out of a long list of young people who submitted their work. We want you to hear those poets this week on Greater LA and on KCRW's Morning Edition. Allow me to introduce to you Salome Agbaroji. She is 16 years old. She's a junior at Gar High School in Artesia. Salome likes to perform her poetry live. And back in December, she was the youngest ever participant and a winner at the Ill List Poetry Slam up in Northern California. She was also part of the Get Lit team that won second place in the Brave New Voices Slam. Now, here is Salome Agbaroji reading from her poem, Pretty Places of L.A.
This is what you call pretty. Yeah, pretty shines like heirloom pearls, not pretty like glimmer of grills in teeth. No, pretty like veneers and messy bun. Not pretty like barrettes on little black girls, or street tacos, or graffiti done by people far too talented for their circumstance, or broken glass, or the unironic musicality of barbershops. Definitely not like that sweet little old lady with only six teeth but still smiled at me anyway like I was her own granddaughter. Nah, that ain't pretty. But I've been to places pretty. And I can assure you, those pretty places have got nothing on the heart of this city.
That's 16-year-old poet Salome Agbaroji reading from her poem, Pretty Places of L.A. Hi, Salome.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm all right. Thank you for doing this.
Of course. I'm happy to be here.
What is it about poetry slams that you like so much?
Yeah, honestly, I'm not that much of a slam girl because I actually got into poetry around 2020 and, you know, everything was shut down. But in December when I did the Illest Slam, that was one of my first opportunities to be in front of a live audience and feed off of their energy, see how they react to the words I had like painstakingly written in my bedroom, you know, with all my passion and emotions. So it was a very good experience. And I think all poets that perform live can attest to the fact that poetry is such a living thing. Just as we are, it reflects us. So when we see it come to life on a stage, it just adds a whole new layer to the words and the meaning.
Tell us a little bit about the poem that you submitted to the Young Creators Project here at KCRW. I mean, this poem is called Pretty Places of L.A. What was the inspiration behind it?
Yeah, the initial inspiration is actually a story I really love to tell. My sister and I, we love to go on drives just as a way to release stress and to hang out, have fun. And one of our drives led us to Leimert Park, which is one of the most magical places in LA I've been, because, you know, I'm from here and I've been all over. But Leimert Park was just a place where Black and Brown communities were really like embracing themselves. I saw incense and African art and Black and Brown food. I saw Hispanic communities, and it showed me that when we think of LA, those are the communities that are not represented. We think of Beverly Hills, we think of palm trees and, you know, high-rise buildings and things like that. But the most welcoming and homely feeling for me, especially as a Nigerian, I'm first generation Nigerian, seeing my culture and cultures of other different people being represented in the tight-knit, such family-oriented spaces was so beautiful to me. And I just had to write a poem about it because the people that made me feel so at home and made me feel so celebrated deserve just as much as a platform as the high-rise buildings and the LA beaches.
What do you want to do, Salome, when you're done with high school and you're done with your education? I mean, what do you want to do? What do you want to be?
I would say teenagers have a lot of pressure to know what we want to do. And I'm trying to embrace the process and take things as they come. I never planned when I was in elementary school that in high school I'd be a poet, but here we are. But I can say for sure that my career will have a positive impact on communities that need advocacy and need equity to be brought to them, that need a voice given to them. It will definitely maintain my art, whether that's in a poetic form or a music lyric or a speech that I'm giving. Art will always follow me through my journey. But yeah, definitely my art will stay with me and advocacy will be a huge part of it.
Now, something tells me, Salome, that whatever you choose, you are going to crush it.
Thank you.
No, thank you for submitting your work so a lot of folks can hear it. Salome Agbaroji is a poet. She joined us as part of KCRW's Young Creators Project. By the way, you can read her poem, the full poem, at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Salome, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
By the way, KCRW's Young Creators Project continues for the month of May. The focus is visual arts, and we're going to be accepting submissions all month long. So So be sure to check it out at kcrw.com/young creators. That's all the time we have for today. Join us tomorrow. The drought has us talking about water restrictions yet again. More on what that could mean for you and what's a better way to prepare for years like this. What about capturing all that water that falls, say, in the wet season? That's tomorrow on this program. We're online at kcrw.com/GLA. How are you doing? Share your thoughts with us. Give us some story ideas, too. And don't forget, you can get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, as well as at kcrw.com/GreaterLA, or GLA for short. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Rebecca Ludman, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped with this episode this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your time and attention, and of course, your ears. Have a great night.